Welcome to The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by Dragonmount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series written by Robert Jordan. There are currently 11 novels in the main series, as well as one prequel novel.
Sadly, in September of 2007, as he was working on finishing the series, Robert Jordan lost a long and hard-fought battle.
However, despite the loss of its creator, the wheel turns on.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Welcome to another edition of the Fourth Age podcast about Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time. This is Andrew Gellos. With us today is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew, and hi, everybody. Thanks for listening today. We've got a great show for you. Today we'll be talking about Padon Thain. And with us today for the first time is Mark. Mark, say hello to everybody and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, Virginia, for that beautiful introduction. My name's Mark. I'm from Alberta, Canada. I've been reading the Wheel of Time for 12 years or so now, and I just find it absolutely amazing how much you guys have done with this, and I'm extremely honored that you would let me join you in some of your podcast discussions.
Just a reminder to everybody who may or may not remember this, but almost every single topic we discuss has spoilers, and today is no different. So if you haven't read anything past about the first book, it would be a good idea to tune out now, finish reading the series, and then come back to this podcast, because we will most likely ruin at least one or two things for you, if not more.
Our topic for today actually came to us from an email. Sarah writes to us and says, "Hi, love your show. I am hoping you'll do a show about Padon Thain and Morgoth. I am interested in exploring Fain's relationship with the Dark One before going to Shadar Logoth, all those years that he spent spying on the Two Rivers. Also, his power over Murdrel and the Black Odge." Definitely want to thank Sarah for that email. As I responded in a similar email, I've always found Thain to be one of the most intriguing characters in The Wheel of Time. Very early on, when I was still associating characters from The Wheel of Time with other literature series, I immediately made the Gollum association from Lord of the Rings, and I'm really, really glad that that association went away, because I think Padon stands out as a very, very unique and individual character.
Well, I definitely have to agree with that. He's certainly complex, and he's certainly had so many influences on him.
For all of the characters that we've seen through most of the series, whenever it comes to Padon Thain, he has got to be probably the most complex, and almost contrary to Robert Jordan's standard style, he's almost the most explained character in the series, at least that I've personally discovered. Because, I mean, every time you turn around, there's something more about Thain surfacing here, a mention of him there, and it's just, there's so much about him that comes out that it almost seems like not what Robert Jordan would normally do.
Yeah, definitely. Also, he's one of the longer-stretching characters when you really think about it. His initiation into the Society of Dark Friends stretches back 40 years before the Eye of the World takes place, when he is first taken to the Pit of Doom and chosen by the Dark One to act as one of several spies who were hunting for the Dragon Reborn, even before Rand was even conceived. He's a continuous character. He keeps popping up pretty much when you least expect him. Have the Eye of the World, where he slips in and out and in and out, and he'll disappear here and there. And then when you least expect it, Rand is in Murrindi, and out of nowhere, you know, Thain shows up with, you know, weird ghost images of dead Ashaman, and it's just amazingly odd.
Yeah, and you can't forget the time he was in the area outside of Cairhien with Torm Riotan. I mean, that was a place where no one in their right mind would have expected him to show up, and he did, and he caused, from there, an extremely essential plot point in the rest of the series with the dagger from Shadar Logoth that made the neat little nick across the circular wound caused by Ishmael. Gave that little nick across there that's caused so much grief and strife and pain and everything else from that point on all the way to even where we are now at the end of the 11th book.
Well, and speaking of Shadow Logos, that has to be one of the defining points in this character's evolution, since that was where he actually became assimilated, evidently, or merged with Mordeth, who was the counselor to the king of Eridol before they basically turned on themselves and destroyed themselves through their evil. But he ended up in Shadow Logoth because he's following Rand, because of what the Dark One did to him, that basically, in a sort of Gollum-esque fashion, they took him and basically distilled his knowledge of the three boys and the two rivers and fed it back to them so that he could follow them at all times and sense their whereabouts. So it's then combining with Mordeth just made him even more complex.
Yeah, and I like that word. I liked the choice of wording when they talked about Thane's experiences, because primarily he was chosen because his occupation as a traveling merchant or a peddler took him to several places all over, and the Shadow only had a vague idea of where the dragon might surface, so having someone who could travel was essential in looking for their ultimate enemy, or their ultimate pawn, depending on how you look at things. And then every time that he would return to the Pit of Doom, they distilled him. You know, they took, you know, just imagine, you know, ripping the memories and the thoughts and, you know, things, what is Thane, out of him, and, like, condensing it down into a raw, refined, you know, material, and then putting it back in so that he just constantly grows more and more attached to his quarry. And, I mean, they use him as sort of a, you know, genetically rebred hunting dog for the Dragon Reborn, and it's just kind of really interesting.
Right, and he's so compelled to follow them that they mentioned at one point in time that he couldn't even stop to eat other than, like, snatching grubs and beetles as he stumbled on and ran. He could barely sleep or do anything. It really wasn't until he merged with Mordeth somehow, or Mordeth took over a part of him, that he was able to begin to act a little bit more on his own. And it seems to be at that point that he acquired his little tricks and his powers over the Myrdral and became a much stronger and more formidable opponent, and not apparently as controlled by the Dark One as he was in the past. What do you think about that, Mark?
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. It wasn't until that point that he actually managed to break free and become his own person again, at least insofar as you can become your own person when you've got the soul of a hundreds of years old, greedy, power-hungry person named Mordeth infesting you.
Yeah, the control over the Myrdral, I'm not certain about. Control over other Dark Friends, the Black Aja, and other things like that. That really comes from the fact that when you really think about the hierarchy of the Dark Friends, because they do have an odd hierarchy, Thane being this principal sort of hunter for the Dragon Reborn actually has to sit pretty high. I mean, Alviarin was the head of the Black Aja, and therefore she has to sit on, like, that inner circle of 13 or whatever it was, really high levels of the Dark Friend, and yet he seemed to be able to kind of hold his own, if not, you know, kind of push her around a little bit. And I think part of that has to come from just the creepy factor that Mordeth gives him. He seems to be able to do things, and more importantly, he can handle that dagger without, you know, the horribly corrupting effect that, you know, we saw it used on Matt.
Yeah, that's true. Although, from what I gather, and I don't mean to actively dispute your comments there, Andrew, but Alviarin, while being really high up as the head of the Black Aja, I don't know how far up in the actual hierarchy of the Dark Friend she is. I mean, you could assume she's high up, or she could also be just one of the lower ends. I mean, she's high in her circle of areas, but as has been said many a times in some of the other books, if the theoretical beggar comes up to you with the right symbols, you would bow your head, kiss the floor beneath his feet, and not speak until he said anything. So, I mean, I tend to think that Alviarin is roughly middling level on the hierarchy, whereas Fane, because of all of his usefulness, as you said, is kind of a little bit higher up in the chain of command.
Well, my take on it is sort of, regardless of where she is in the Dark Friend Society, she has to at least be on the level of a low end, at the very least, Dreadlord, because she is a channeler who is a Dark Friend, and that's where my thoughts on that go, where Fane would fit in against that. I would still probably put him higher, or at least on an equivalent level, because he's fairly important to the Shadow, at least up until he starts acting in his own interest. The Dark One made him a tool for his own purposes, and Fane never seems to be able to get away from that. I mean, it's that, you know, I completely hate the Dark One and everything he stands for what he's done to me, but I can't stop utilizing the effects of what he's done to me.
And that's a very good point. I mean, from the way you describe it there, it actually kind of fits along the lines of, I'd almost equate him kind of like, at least to some modern type things, as an addict. They know it's bad, at least some of them do, and they want to quit, but he still can't stop.
But I have to interject one slight disagreement, and I believe that at some point in time after he merged with Mordith, that Fane became almost a renegade. I don't think he's really strictly under the Dark One's control anymore, and I believe that's why Slayer, Isam combination, I believe that's why he's been sent to kill Fane. I believe he's been sent by either the Forsaken or the Dark One himself. They've got a contract out on him, basically. I think he's gone rogue.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Yes, he has gone rogue, but for some reason, a lot of the stuff that had happened to him, like his ability to sense Rand and that, he still kept it, even though he is no longer relatively within the Dark Lord's favor. I mean, he seems to have had quite a few falling outs. He's higher up in the command hierarchy, so I mean, he's ordering all these lower-level Dark Friends around with him, but he's got the contract on him because the Great Lord can't really control him, but that doesn't mean that he still doesn't have access to all the abilities that they've managed to instill in him at the time.
Oh, I agree with that. He's still got all the same abilities. I just wonder if he's still serving the Dark Lord as actively as he was in the past. I can't imagine killing off Shadowspawn like Murdral and everything would be something that the Dark One would be very happy to have him doing, and I think he's actually messing up a lot of plans that people are making.
Yeah, but the best part about that is the fact that at least all of the Forsaken and everything, they always try and mess up each other's plans. So a lot of them, at least from what I gather, seem to think that he's working for at least one or the other of the other Forsaken. So, I mean, all the plan messing up, that just sort of fits in with everything that's been going on with them since their time back in the Age of Legends.
Well, that's true. I can't argue with that. I just wonder how much control the Dark One still has over him. I don't know why, but in the back of my mind, I feel like the Dark One was one of the ones that wanted Fane dead as well as the Forsaken.
I wouldn't use the word control. I think that it's more of a compulsion. All of the years of service to the Dark One has developed as a kind of compulsive attitude or set of behaviors within Fane. And while the Dark One isn't actively controlling him, there's still that the presence of his influence is there, and it's something that I don't think Fane is capable of shaking off. He may not like it, or may not, you know, may be acting more for himself, but I think there's an undercurrent of what the Dark One did to him that's still pervading a number of his actions, and when Fane becomes conscious of it, I think that's possibly when he becomes more inflictive towards things like, you know, Murdral or other Dark Friends, because I'm remembering that one scene where he was ordering a couple of lower Dark Friends around, I want to say, and he uses his creepy Mashadar powers, essentially, because that's what they are, to kind of make a puppet out of this woman's son. And it was just, you know, he's talking about reaching out with something, not really knowing what it was, you know, and it the wisp of gray, you know, touched him, and the boy was, like, lost or something. It was really weird and kind of surreal, to be quite honest.
That's an interesting thought. I agree with the idea that he's still got some underlying influences, but it's not as strong as it used to be ever since he joined up with Mordeth, because Mordeth has his own thing, and the people of Aridhul hated the Shadow more so than most, that they became evil in their own way to fight evil.
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely agree, because it's that... It's the wound from Fane's dagger that gives Rand the idea on how to cleanse the male half of the One Power against the Dark One's taint, because of the way that the wounds would pulse in opposition to each other, particularly if they were around one of the major influences, either the taint or the opposite taint of Shadar Logoth.
But isn't it interesting that the correlation between the two wounds sort of fighting against each other that Dahmer Flynn sealed off to try and contain them, and the conflict that must be raging inside Fane as well, because he's not only been controlled and changed by the Dark One, but now he's also partly Mordeth, who was a, you know, as you said, Aridhul, they were great haters of the Shadow and actually became as evil as they did in their quest to defeat the Shadow, that they would say the victory of the light was all and meant nothing else, and they just became so determined to do that that in the ends justified any means to them. So there's the same sort of conflict raging inside Fane as there is basically in Rand's wounds. I'm just wondering exactly how that might correlate on a larger scale. I wonder where Fane is going in the next book. I mean, he's being hunted by Slayer, who's told, I believe he told Perrin at some point in time that he was a renegade. So I'm not sure who Slayer's answering to. I presume the Forsaken. I don't know if the Dark One controls him directly or not. And also that trick that you were talking about with the boy, I don't think he was controlling the boy. It was basically putting in some sort of convulsion. He would just basically have like seizures or convulsions when he did that to somebody. And I don't know if that's the same sort of thing that he did to the Murdral. He never really said how he did it. He just told one of them, I know how to hurt your kind, but he was able to, you know, tie up and chain a Murdral and keep it in his tent and then kill one and nail it to the barn door, so he's obviously got a lot of power.
Well, it's an interesting thing to think about, and I've kind of had this question in mind since reading Sarah's email. We know that Mordeth from Aridhul was an amazingly influential person. He was a personal advisor to the king, much like, you know, Ishamael served as for Archer Hawkwing during one of his brief unsealing portions from the Boar. And he had an amazing amount of influence. And in the mid and later books, we see Fane in the company of some very powerful people. Not just dark friends, you know, like Alviarin, but, you know, men like Pedron Niall, and, you know, the Ammerlin Seat, or at least one of them, Elida. And he seems to have this ability to influence people and make them see a course of action or something, despite the fact that I believe, like, in the earliest books, he's described as a pale, skinny fellow with gangly arms and an enormous beak of a nose. He's also referred to as having very wide ears. I mean, I just imagine this scrawny, goofy-looking guy, and yet at the same time, he seems to be able to just get inside people's head and be like, oh, no, you should really move these troops over here and have them looking in this direction. You know, give me command of a squadron of white cloaks. And the people he's talking to are like, oh, that sounds like a great idea. Sure, I don't trust you, but sure. And I'm wondering, is that something of Fane? Is it something of Mordeth? Or is it just that all-around combination of everything that he's gone through?
I think that's got to be something from Mordeth, because Mordeth was the counselor to the king. He seems to be the power behind the throne sort of mentality most of the time. And he started right out in the Great Hunt with the High Lord Turok trying to influence him. And then, as you mentioned, he talks about how he touched both Pedron Niall and Elida with his taint, so that they would now be so suspicious they wouldn't even trust their own mothers or whatever. And he seems to be going through as many people of power as he can, and that seems to be his modus operandi, to try and influence the mighty to do his bidding. So I don't know who he's going to get to next.
Well, there's not that many people left that he can try and go for other than the Borderlanders. I mean, Rand already is on top of the world when it comes to Kyrian. He's left his steward there. He's in charge of Tyr. He's the king of Ilion. He's got one of his girlfriends is the queen of Andor and soon to be the queen of Kyrian. He's got Yael behind him. The only place he doesn't really have a true foothold is Pharmadding and Murrindi. But even then, Murrindi isn't too far gone from him because he has Matt, whose Band of the Red Hand helped control that area there. So that covers that section. The Shan-Chan have Arad Doman. They've got Falm. They've got Tanchico. They've got some of the Seafolk Isles. They've got Amadicia. And they've got Ebu Dar and Altara. So, I mean, there's the only places really left that aren't under control of forcible people who can resist Paten Fain would be the Borderlanders. And even then, they're far from weak-willed people.
They're not only far from weak-willed people, the rulers of those nations aren't in those nations at all. If you remember, they're still heading south towards where they think Rand is. And it's really weird because, you know, I don't know that he would go to the borderlands anyway. I think that probably takes him a little too close to the Blight. And as much as he's, you know, rogue, and as much as he does do things contrary to the Shadow, I think he's probably still a little leery of getting too close to, you know, the Pit of Doom. You know, you never know what will happen the closer you get to one of the major influences or one of the major turning points of your existence.
Does Fane know that Slayer is actively hunting him? Have we heard
I
that?
I tend to think not, but I haven't. I don't remember reading anything in the most recent books, which I just read about probably 6 months ago or less. I don't remember reading anything at all about him being actively aware of that.
And I just had this flash while Andrew was talking that I have nothing to support this in the books. It just came to me. But I wonder, when he mentioned the Borderlanders, it popped into my head. I wonder if he has access to Davron Bashir, and I don't recall if Davron Bashir knows Fane or knows the threat that he poses, and I just have that memory of Min's viewing about something dark around Davron, and I know he's a good guy, I don't think he's going to turn to the Shadow, but if he's tainted by Fane, there's no way to be sure.
He does know about Paten Fane, at least I'm fairly certain it is. I'd have to read the exact quote, but there was a mention. Rand was talking with Davram, and I believe it was back when Mazrim Taim first showed up, or something of the like, and Rand said that there is a 10,000 gold crown price on the head of Paten Fain because of what he did to the Two Rivers, and I could swear that Bashir was there at the same time.
I'm thinking that might have been in the tent in Kurien, and I think he said that to Caroline Damodred, and she said that that was more than a ransom for a queen. That doesn't mean he didn't say it to Bashir, but I remember that particular scene. And even if he knew, you know, Aram knew that Perrin and Rand thought that Nasima was a big problem, and yet he still allowed himself to be influenced by him. So it doesn't mean that, you know, Fane or Mordeth couldn't weasel his way into somebody's good graces, even if they knew he might be an issue. It was just a thought. I'm not really sure if I have that as a crazy theory or not. I don't have enough support for it. Do you think there are any white cloaks that are still under his thumb? You know, might he cause problems for Galad, who's now basically, I believe, Lord Captain Commander of the White Cloaks? I wonder if Fane might try and weasel his way in there.
I'm not sure. From what I can tell, a lot of the people that he had influence with when he was with the White Cloaks are dead now. I mean, the big one being Pedro Niall. He did have some White Cloaks working for him through Niall's orders, but if I remember properly, people like Valda and the other White Cloaks who knew Mordeth when he was posing as Ordeath really despised him. They all really seemed to kind of like hate him, those that knew he was there, because I'm pretty sure he was meeting in secret with Niall most of the time, and a lot of people didn't actually know that he was around. But I think a lot of his connections to the White Cloaks are now pretty much dissolved.
I think that's probably true. I think the one that they really despised the most that was around Niall was Seven Balwer, who is now with Perrin. But I don't recall that they despised Fane. I know Dane Bornhold really despised him because he really resented that Pedro Nile had sent him off to the Two Rivers, let him be in basically command of the white cloaks that he had under him. Just not sure what his next move is going to be. Surely he's going to try something. He's just been too prominent in every book for his influence to go away. I'm sure he's got a big part in the last battle, or the leading up to it.
Indeed, there's got to be something big that's going to happen with him. I mean, as you said, he's just been, whenever he pops up, it's not just, oh, there's Padden Thane. Oh, well. No, he pops up, he does something big, and then he vanishes again until he needs to pop up again. Like in book 10 there, when they're in Farmadding, he shows up, he ends up killing those two renegade Ashaman, and it's like, wow, that's more than just a little coincidental there.
Well, clearly he's following Rand. You know, at all times, he's staying as close to him as he can. And I wonder if he still has the problem that he had in the Great Hunt when he was following them to Carrion, or actually leading them to Carrion, and Rand and Matt and Perrin were following him, and then they went into the Mirror's world. But he couldn't sense Rand when Rand was in the Void, or channeling the One Power, and I think he also couldn't sense him very well when he was in that alternate world. But now that Rand is channeling so much more, I wonder if that makes it more difficult for him to get a lock on it.
I tend to agree, and that's one point I was hoping to bring up at some point in this discussion, was his ability to sense Rand being chunked out because of that. And it came to me almost instantly that it was because Rand was in the Void and channeling the power. But if you remember, way back when, Payne was given the ability to distill and find all three of those, of the three main guys, not just Rand. He focuses on Rand because Rand was more important. It has since proclaimed himself to be the Dragon Reborn and has done a whole lot more about himself. But he still does have the ability to sense Rand, which means he also probably, 99.9% sure, has the ability to sense and find Matt and Perrin. So, I mean, if you think about that and all the unexpected complications that can arise there, what would happen if he went after them instead?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think he sort of threw off a lot of that compulsion after the merging in Shadow Logoth. He was, at one point, very conflicted because he was compelled to follow all three, and then the three boys got split up after Shadow Logoth, and he was in a world of hurt because of that. And I think now that he's more his own man and a renegade, he's focused on Rand because he hates Rand the most. But that doesn't mean that he couldn't try to get to Rand through Perrin or Matt. Surely they know the danger of him, but that doesn't mean that he couldn't, you know, try to corrupt somebody around them. Certainly they'd be vulnerable to, you know, an attack from somebody that they thought was, you know, one of their friends or one of their cohorts that they're with at the moment, and if they were corrupted and turned by Thane, that could be very dangerous to either one of them, not just Rand.
It's interesting that you mention him hating Rand the most, and as I was looking through a quick sort of synopsis of points on Encyclopedia Watt of the times we've seen Thane in the series, his hatred of Rand seems to grow, and I was kind of thinking about, you're talking about how the ability to sense Rand is muted when he's channeling. I wonder if, you know, that's just a byproduct of the frustration. You know, that, you know, Fane's learning to hate Rand more and more and more, even though Rand really, truthfully, except for existing, hasn't done anything significant to Fane up until Book 10, when Fane comes at Rand with the illusory Ashaman, and kind of Rand sees through that illusion and cuts Fane with a sword. And it is one of those weird things that I kind of wonder about is, you know, is Fane's lack of appearance after that particular thing, because he's recovering from that wound, you know, how does that all tie in? You know, what's really driving the hatred that Fane has for Rand?
Well, I think he holds them responsible. It's mostly Rand, but he holds all of them responsible for what was done to him. He mentions that in his point of view several times, that not only was the world going to pay, but that was one of the reasons that he was now on his own after the three Ta'veren, because it's all their fault that the Dark One did what they did to him. And he was very happy that now he had these additional powers and was able to break free more and become his own person. He's now an independent agent, or renegade, but I think he's still cooking something up. And I kind of wonder, the two people that I think he's most likely to go after would be Elaine and maybe Perrin. I think that I think his next move is going to be to try and hurt Rand through his friends and loved ones again, since he's had a pretty bad record in trying to attack Rand, basically.
True, but every time he seems to go after Rand's friends and family and stuff, it ends up working for a short while and then backfiring and getting him into even more trouble than he was in beforehand.
Yeah, but he's mad, so he may not be able to perceive that.
The other thing that I have on that particular note, with his increasing hatred of Rand, he also has become more obsessive about being the one to kill him. I think that's going to keep Fane close to Rand, because when the quote-unquote renegade Ashaman went after Rand, Fane was first on the ball to kill them at a particular glance. And I mean, he even whispered in one of their ears, you know, Althor is mine, you know, only I can kill him, as he's like cuts him with the dagger and walks on through the crowd to leave the Ashaman dying as a bloated corpse in the street.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. He is probably going to stick pretty close to Rand, but I think he's going to have to get another... His modus operandi is to find somebody powerful and attach himself to them as an advisor and then basically corrupt them into doing what he wants. And I'm trying to think of which people are left that he could. And the Ashaman seem like kind of a prime area. What if he's one of the ones who's influencing Mazrim Time or Loghain or one of those others, like I said, Davram or somebody that's close to Rand and trying to corrupt them?
Yeah, it could happen, although Mazrim Time has a better or more likely chance of it being attached to him than Loghain, because Loghain has proven himself, or attempted to prove himself many a times to Rand, that he's good and useful and on his side, whereas Taim is almost as renegade, at least in my mind, as Padden Fane is. So I don't think it'll happen with Loghain, because Loghain's been around Rand a lot, at least in Knife of Dreams he was around there a lot, and he was also big pro-Rand in some of the other books after he escaped and was gentled and stuff. So I don't think that'll happen, especially since Rand is quite public about his get Padden Fane and I'll give you 10,000 gold, because 10,000 gold back then is much akin to like a million plus nowadays.
Actually, we had a discussion about this on the podcast forum in the comments to the last episode, and some of us were kind of searching for the dark friends that we know are close to Rand, because we know somebody's hiding close to him. And I actually think that Loghain might be one of those, because Min said he was going to have power and glory, but she didn't say it was necessarily going to be because he was a good guy. He could have power and glory as a dark friend, too. And somebody has got to be close to him. That means that someone in there, besides the ones that we know about, like Elsa, we know she's a dark friend, and a few others, some of those I think are going to be ones that we're going to discover, much as we did with Aram, that they are either working on their own or actively working for the Dark One. And I think that Fane is kind of a random factor. I don't think he's doing the Dark One's bidding so much anymore, but he certainly wants to get Rand, so as far as he's concerned, if he's helping out the Shadow, but it kills Rand, I don't think he's really going to care. So I wouldn't be surprised if he tried to corrupt somebody that was close to him now. We didn't see much of Padden Fane in either Crossroads of Twilight or Knife of Dreams. I don't actually know what he was doing, but I'm sure he was someplace.
Well, I think the wound he received probably has to do with that, because, you know, he attacked Rand in Pharmadding and got, you know, basically a sword across the gut. I mean, if he survived it, which I have no doubt that he did, that's still pretty serious injury. And as the later books keep getting shorter and shorter in time period, it might just be that, you know, he's had to lay low and recover, because, you know, he probably came pretty close to dying from the wound he received.
It's very possible. And I didn't remember that he had been wounded that badly, but my memory is sometimes full of more holes than Matt's used to be.
There have been many a times where Fane is, like, challenged in such a way where you'd think, out of all the things that happens, he should be dead by now. And still he manages to pull through. I mean, there was the time where he attacked Rand again back in Cairhien with Torm Riot, and there was a time he attacked then, and, I mean, there was, like, two knives thrown at him and a sword stabbing at him that he twisted around. It's like, where the heck did a guy like this manage to learn how to do that?
Well, maybe when the Dark One distilled all of the knowledge that he had of Rand and Perrin and Matt and fed it back into him, maybe he acquired some of the Dark One's own luck at the same time.
At the same time, I am reminded of Gollum, because whenever someone would try to attack him in the Lord of the Rings series, you know, he was always, you know, slimy and twisty and kind of shifting around and, you know, kind of just being able to dodge and avoid. So, I mean, part of it probably just comes from general experience of the world, I think.
True. And you're bringing up Gollum there just sort of also leads to the possibility where being evil gives you all this extra keep yourself alive, instinctive skills and defenses and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, Mordeth survived his own passing away in, you know, in Eridol. You know, his soul, for lack of a better term, became, you know, trapped as this, you know, a massive portion of what it was Mashadar. I is that what actually corrupted the ways, because I think it was probably a weird combination between the taint of the Dark One and the blackness of Eridol, because you think about it, Fain is the only person who has exhibited any real control over Maka and Sheen.
That's true. It was almost, it recognized him as a kindred spirit, I believe, Maureen said. But I don't believe that that Fain was killed by Mashadar. I believe it was Mordeth who was searching for a body to take over. If he could get to the gates with somebody, he could take over their body, Moraine said. And I believe that when he took over Fain, he just found something that was just so even more tainted and corrupt by the Dark One than Mordeth himself, that they sort of merged together and Fain actually ended up being the dominant personality. That seems to be that something that Robert Jordan has done quite a bit. Obviously, we have Rand and Luz Theron and all of his many mergings, and Luke and Isam merging into Slayer. So it's just sort of a common thread there.
Well, yeah, what I was basically saying there was Mordeth had survived his own death. I think Fain, he sort of merged. They became a weird symbiosis of the two personalities. Yeah, I think it's kind of that idea that, somewhat like Mark said earlier, just being that corrupted and that far away from everything that's natural seems to kind of give a tendency to you hold on to life, you know, that much harder. And for some reason, you know, you just don't want to give up and die, which is good for all of us because, you know, now we have another sort of secondary antagonist for Rand that we can never count on being completely gone.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm going to interject something here, which is, here's a brown Aja mode alert. I have to contradict you a little bit. I was just looking in Winter's Harp in the chapter Blue Carp Street. Rand sees Fain out of the corner of his eye and lunges at him, and Fain dances away from his cut. It never actually says that Rand got steel on him at all. And then Fain immediately in the next chapter, Rand goes into combat with Torum. Fain runs out. Rand never actually does cut him, according to the book. Well, so I guess the $64,000 question here will be, what do you think Fain's role in the last battle is going to be? Or is he going to have one? Or is he going to get killed before the last battle?
Honestly, I think he will survive to the last battle. I think he will be his usual ruckus raiser type self, renegade, do his own thing, try and reap as much trouble as he can. But I think he's going to actually end up falling to the nice little syndrome of big bad guy dies to first-time fighter dude who has no idea what the heck's going on. He just sees somebody and stabs, and boom, Fain's dead.
That's an interesting thought there. I originally was going to say that I definitely think he'll show up at the last battle. I think he'll probably actually play some role in, you know, maybe the entire His Blood on the Rocks thing will be the result of another attack by Fain, you know, as a maybe possibility, but that he would end up surviving. He would be that looming darkness that still exists in the world after the last battle, but no one quite knows where he is. But now that you've said that, I'm kind of liking that idea that, you know, Fain is, you know, standing there triumphant, and then just Joe Nobody comes up and gets him, and suddenly it's like, wow, I so didn't see that coming.
It definitely would fall in with RJ's style, something that nobody in their right mind would see coming, and it just happens.
I think Fain's going to be off before the last battle, to be honest with you. I think he's going to try some grand attack on either Rand or Matt or Perrin, and somebody, maybe somebody like Oliver that we aren't expecting at all, is just going to take him out.
I actually like that idea of Oliver doing it, especially since he's sort of becoming one of those characters that you don't really know what's going to happen with him. He's an oddball type character that's there and becoming more prominent in the fact that he's not doing anything. So, yeah, I could kind of see Oliver come up out of nowhere because of all the training from his various Red Hand uncles, quote-unquote. I actually really like that idea.
Oh, good. And, well, to be honest with you, what made me think of that link was the fact that Slayer is after him. And then there is a connection between Matt Noel and Tom Marilyn, who are going to go in to the Tower of Genji, which evidently Slayer seems to be able to duck in and out of at will. And they're going to try to rescue Moraine. And I think that we talked about this in another podcast also, but Oliver will probably end up somehow following them in there, either to try and make sure that Matt's okay or just because he's a curious kid. And I think it would be funny if somehow Fane got involved in that whole melee rescue attempt from the Ilfin and the Ilfin. I'm trying to tie up everything together here. Somehow somehow Brandon Sanderson is going to have to deal with a lot of characters at once, and if he can pull a lot of them from different areas into one unusual conflict, that could resolve a lot of threads in actually a fairly small number of pages.
Yeah, but since when has RJ's style been to solve a lot of threads in just a couple of pages like that?
Oh, no. He goes on and on of all the leading up to it. But if you actually look at the number of pages involved in, say, the battle at Dumai's Wells or the attack at Carrion on him by Fane and all the things where the major characters get injured, he wraps those up in a few pages. It's actually kind of scary in a way how little time he actually devotes to resolving the major conflicts once they actually come to a head.
Yeah, now that you think about it, that does make a lot more sense. He does seem to lead up, and then boom, everything happens. I mean, when the big example of that, which just totally blows my thought out of the water, is the cleansing of the source.
Yeah, it actually didn't take him very long to do all that. He spent more time on other people's point of view of that event, all the channelers that were in various parts of Randland, you know, who could feel all that source. He spent a lot more time on their perception of it than he actually did the event, I believe. Look at the battle surrounding all that business in Winter's Heart was like the very last chapter.
Yeah, another similar instance was the battle at Malden, where Perrin goes to rescue Fael. How many chapters did we have about Perrin following Fael, Perrin finding out where she is, Perrin, you know, going, laying out the plans and getting the supplies and everything that he was going to need to be able to utilize the Shanshan to help fight the battle. And the battle starts and you've got a really quick and exciting, you know, barrage of the One Power being used, pretty much one-sided because all of the Wise One channelers were, you know, doped up on
fork root
tea. And then out of nowhere, they're all just suddenly, the battle's almost over before it begins when you really think about it. And, you know, Perrin rushes down there and we get a really quick blurb where Aurum attacks Perrin, you know, having been convinced that Perrin's a dark friend and gets, you know, Aurum gets cut down really quickly and you have Roland leading Fael out and Perrin misunderstanding and killing Roland, and you know the battle, everything leading up to the battle was such a huge amount of pressure, you know, to be, you know, resolved really quickly. Kind of gives a really an explosive effect when you think about it. It's that timer on the time bomb where, you know, it's ticking down and those last 5 seconds seem to take forever and then just boom and everything is everywhere and, you know, it's such a great impact.
All right. I sit corrected. I was wrong. I will make it publicly available for everyone to know. Mark was wrong.
Alert the media!
But yeah, people, feel free to keep sending me emails. Let me know where I've screwed up, how I've screwed up, whether it's a pronunciation, whether it's one of my facts, one of my thoughts, one of my crazy ideas. Feel free to send in feedback. Our email, you can reach us at any time, is podcast@dragonmount.com.
And don't forget, you can always also post on our forums, which is at www.dragonmount.com. And we are under the forum page for the Fourth Age. Send us a voicemail or criticisms, anything you feel like, through our voicemail system at 1-888-333-7690.
And I don't believe that we've received any comments or feedback on the voicemail recently, so here I am asking you all to send us a voicemail, because then we can just play it over the air and you can be on the show too. We love to hear your comments, and as a lot of you know, I'm fairly active on the comments section of the podcast, so feel free to chime in and criticize and send in your comments. We love to hear from you.
All right, and with that, we'd like to thank each and every one of you guys for taking the time to listen to our random ramblings of no sense things and possible some senses. So with that, my name is Mark. I wish you all a great day, night, evening, whatever the heck time it is when you listen to this. Farewell.
Thanks, Mark. This is Virginia thanking everybody for listening. We really appreciate you. We enjoy doing this, and we hope you enjoy it as well. So until next time, may the light illumine you.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and all of us here at the Fourth Age Podcast, Saravya Ninto, Manshima, Tai Shitang.